Hi there, I'm Georgie Ainsley, and every week I talk to someone who is a performance person. They could be an athlete from the world of entertainment, business, or politics. They could even be an astronaut. The key link is, of course, that they all know how to perform at the top level, and they can teach us all a thing or two about how to do that in our own lives, at whatever it is that we do. Performance People is available wherever you get your podcasts, or of course, you can watch us on YouTube, where you can also subscribe, and please do. Richard Joseph is CEO of Joseph Joseph, a product design company hell-bent on solving everyday household problems. Richard and his twin Anthony designed their first product together in 2003, a glass chopping board. From there, they've gone on to build a company that made a pre-tax profit of £20 million last year. Quite a journey for the brothers from Birmingham who used to sleep in the car outside trade shows.
It's the bit we love. But it's also, we know that if we get that right, and it's not easy, but if we get it right, the business will flourish on the back of it. So I still carve out lots of time for that, as well as trying to then manage the other parts of the business.
I mean, is that a little bit like how you feel about some of your products or any of them? Have you been on that sort of like emotionally quite connected journey with these products?
You know, sometimes you get it wrong. And like I said, failure is part of the journey, and we do fail, but we just try and learn. We fail fast, we move on, and we learn from it.
So, Rich, this will appeal to our generation of listeners for sure. If you've got a problem, who do you call? Some people go to Ghostbusters. I go to you. I go to Richard Joseph for all problems relating to startups. So whether that be supply chain, product design, whatever it is, my first phone call has now become the phone call that I place to you. When you guys started this company 20 odd years ago, you and your brother, twins as well, hence Joseph Joseph, did you ever foresee it becoming what it is now? Was that the game plan? How did you head into this? What were your ambitions 20 odd years ago?
So I'd say we never thought it would obviously be where it is today. You know, you start off just, we were two product designers. We loved product design, even as children, as kids, we were in the garage at home creating crazy inventions together, making stuff that went nowhere. But we loved, creating stuff. So we started out the same way, really. I think we started off just designing products that we thought were cool and sort of solved a problem. And we wanted to sort of design the next product. So we thought we needed to sell what we were doing in order to create a bit of money then to put into the second product and the third product. And it just sort of went from there. So we went on that journey, and here we are sort of 20 years later, and still here, which is great.
I mean, you're synonymous with many things, but the chopping board is one of them. We'll get to that in a minute. But when you first started mulling over, the two of you, what that first product would look like, obviously you're problem solvers. I mean, you come from the school of Dyson as well, so you've got that experience behind you. And very much it's a problem solution business and all about functionality. I want to know what the first product was that you two came up with that didn't make it to the design floor. Was there something in the first instance that you both mulled over that you thought, I think this has potential, and maybe it did or didn't get there?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we first started out, we actually launched four products, three of which were a disaster, didn't go anywhere, and one made it. And that was the one that then took us forward it took us on the journey we've been on. There's been many, many products over the years that sort of, I guess, failed. We learned a huge amount by it. But in the early days, it was very much like we designed a range of products. So if I take it back, we grew up in Birmingham, and our father and my grandfather set up a manufacturing business in Birmingham. So we came from sort of engineering, manufacturing background. Dad ran a company that made glass, industrial glass components. And so when we, and there were things like cooker hobs and car wing mirrors and, going into the automotive trade in Birmingham and all, the surrounding cities. And when we started out, we were like, look, we'd love to do some consumer goods. We thought it'd be really cool to do something that we'd like to buy ourselves. But in order to get started, we'd make them in the factory, much to this sort of disgust of all these guys producing these Carl Weimer is, and they're like, why have we got to produce a glass chopping board for these guys? But anyway, so we started off with four products. And they were, like I said, they were just things that we thought we'd like. And I mean, we did a glass chopping board, which is a brilliant product because it's super hygienic. So bacteria doesn't stick to it. So, you know, you can use it to chop, prepare, serve food on, etc. So great product. We then did a glass wall clock, which was basically a glass chopping board with a hole in it and a clock mechanism. That did okay for a period of time, but then we sort of discontinued it. So it was very much that sort of trial and error at the start of things we liked, and we thought, well, if we like them, other people might like them.
What are those other two products? Board. I want to know what the other two products were.
And then we did some glass dishes, some serving dishes, but the problem with glass dishes were it's very difficult to make a glass dish work better. So we really struggled with glass dishes. And then we also had some drinking mugs as well. But again, a mug's a mug, and we struggled to work out how to make those better. So they all went by the wayside, and we concentrated on just really functional products. And why we love the chopping board, because everybody uses one more than, you know, 2, 3, 4 times a day. Everyone's got one or more, multiple of. So it's a big market. And we just thought, well, this is great. Why don't we just design stuff, work with products that people use every day? And that was and try and make them work better.
And how many goes does it take before you get something right? Because I remember having this conversation with James Dyson, and obviously, like, you know, thousands of product designs later, you know, you hit gold, having made incremental tiny little changes and adaptations along the way to get you to this place of what you consider to be perfection. I mean, that journey, I mean, what does that look like? It must take a certain type of person to want to go on it.
Yeah, we're constantly failing. I learned that actually from, you know, the time I had at Dyson, working with James Dyson, was that, you know, failure, persistence, well, you learn a huge amount through failure. And I think so we're constantly failing with products. But to give you an idea, we've probably developed over 300 different types of chopping boards over the years. And still developing chopping boards. And people are like, how do you manage to keep going on chopping boards? But there's always, we're constantly looking for problems to solve. But, you know, we launch, between 70 to 100 new products a year. And we have a ratio when we start our design process, which typically takes about 2 years from when we start that ideation, looking for the idea, to when we launch a product. On average, let's say it takes 2 years. We start with 100 ideas. We launch probably 4 to 5 of those ideas. So we have we need to make sure we have, be very broad, open-minded, looking for lots of opportunities, looking at lots of different things, to then through the development process and failure, whittle it right down to the best ideas that we then take forward.
And how do you do that? Do you just shove everybody in a room and just have these huge, great big brainstorming sessions? Is that how it works? No idea is a stupid idea.
I mean, very much so. It's sort of like, I think, you know, we do get people in a room, we go out and we observe, we talk to people, you know, but we basically try and get brilliantly creative, sort of disruptive people together. And listen, isn't it? It's all about listening, you know, really trying not to talk too much, because that's when you sort of, you know, you're going to find the great ideas, or particularly if you get the right people in the room. But we say, like, disruption and being different is really important. So in our design process, and we've developed this over time, but we sort of feel like, you know, because we're designers, we're always trying to develop better products. But actually, what we're looking for is the different idea, the disruptive idea. And if you can marry that with a real problem that you're trying to solve, you generally will end up having a successful product to take forward. And that's also the really fun bit.
Yeah. How easy is it to fall into gimmicking stuff? I mean, how easy is it to overthink a thing and to just overcomplicate? Because I think that thing about, you know, keep it simple, stupid, is a good sort of motto to live by. Because there can be, can't there, a complete tendency to overcomplicate a thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. So at the, you know, trying to understand what is the problem you're trying to solve. That's the first thing. And is this really a problem? I think that the trap you fall into is maybe then you think it's a problem, but actually it isn't a problem at all. And then when you end up with a solution, you know, you go to the market with it to consumers and they're like, yeah, what? I don't get it. Why have you done that? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But if you are solving a real problem, you can identify that problem. Then when you come up with a solution, generally it doesn't have that gimmick. It functions really well and people get it. I mean, one of the best things you can hear, I think, when you launch a new product is when someone says, why didn't someone think of that before? If you hear that, you know you've got it right, because they, you know, it immediately resonates with someone. They've looked at it and go, yeah, my God, that's it. That's exactly what we need. So that's our sort of approach. We're constantly searching for that. But it's identifying the problem. I think most of our energy goes into really trying to observe and look for how can we make a product work better? Is there an issue with the environment that the product is being used in? Is the function not working? How can we improve it? We spend a lot of time looking at that. Coming up with a solution is then probably a bit easier if you've honed in on that, you know, really defined that problem.
And how much of it is gut instinct as well, and just knowing that you're onto something? Because I wonder whether also you've got a big journey. It's sort of a 2-year development, like you say, from ideation to actual reality on customers' shelves. I mean, that is a long old stint of time. And in that time, you know, other products can come out, you know, in that journey time that might trump the thing that you were trying to get on top of.
Yes.
I mean, how do you sort of maintain the confidence in a hunch that then ends up being consumer tested at a latter part of that journey?
I guess there's a bit of experience. You have the process you go through. And so you're constantly trying to refine the process, because the process, let's say the development process, helps us go through various steps along the way and checkpoints to make sure that, are we still on track? Is this thing still delivering what it needs to do? And then as you go through and you start to make, or you start to prototype and test those prototypes, is it, you know, made out of the right materials? Is it made in the right way? Is it going to have a long usable life? So you go through the process, during that process, lots of opportunity for us to say, no, stop. We need to go back, or we need to go in a different direction, or this isn't really working, etc. I think we rely on the team to help us do that. You know, we've got some really clever sort of creative people who are brilliant at working all that sort of stuff out. We will engage with consumers occasionally, but usually that might be quite far down the line. That's usually about when we're actually talking about the product and how we try and communicate it. We need help. Do you understand what we're trying to do, and how are we communicating it in the right way? We'll generally engage with consumers at that point. But we rely a lot on ourselves and up until that point. And so then also, you know, sometimes you get it wrong. And like I said, failure is part of the journey, and we do fail, but we just try and learn. We fail fast, we move on, and we learn from it.
And in terms of both of you, you're both product designers, that's your background, both in design, and you both sort of trod different sort of pathways to get there and then came back together again. When you're now running a really decent business and you've got all the pressures that come with that as a CEO, do you miss out on the bits that got you there? Those moments that are sort of those lovely little gems or nuggets that happen where you go, oh, we're onto something, and you're really in the thick of it. Because as a CEO, you've got this sort of broad overview piece now, haven't you? So do you still get stuck in? Are you still able to do that? Do you miss it if you don't?
So I'm still able to get stuck in, probably much to the annoyance of maybe Anthony, who, you know, a step on his toes a bit. But a big thing for us, and a big thing for me as well, is focus. So, and we, you know, we remember that actually what got us to where we are today is the product, really. I mean, okay, we have a fantastic team, and of course the team has driven the growth and everything else, but ultimately when it boils down, if we focus, it's all about the product. And so we are constantly reminding ourselves of that. And I carve out as much time as I can to spend with the design teams, development teams on product and product development. It's the bit we love, But it's also, we know that if we get that right, and it's not easy, but if we get it right, it will, the business will flourish on the back of it. So I still carve out lots of time for that, as well as trying to then manage the other parts of the business. And for me, like, I think, you know, one of my strengths is product and helping Anthony, working closely with Anthony on the product development side. Then in the other areas, all the senior leadership team are superb. You know, this great A team who are superb at what they do. And I sort of then will hopefully support, encourage, challenge those guys, but they then leave them to get on with, you know, running their parts of the business. I'd much rather sit in a product development meeting and discuss what we're launching next year and get excited about that than I probably would talking about our warehouse strategy. But I have to do both. And the guy running our warehouses is superb. So, you know, thankfully he gets excited about that and I don't have to. But you know, that's all part of it.
And what about the challenges of the world in which we're living now? I mean, I suspect COVID for you would have been an interesting time, because Everybody was based at home and everybody was obsessed with keeping and staying hygienic and clean.
Yeah, I mean, COVID was, it turned the business upside down. I mean, initially when we, back in 2020, when it all started off, the business literally stopped dead. And it was a very sort of terrifying time because no one really knew what was going on. We went into the first lockdown everything in our world stopped. It then picked up quite quickly because everyone was stuck at home. And so they were all using homeware products and our sales sort of recovered quite quickly. And we then went through a period of 18 months where we had very huge disruption to our supply chain. So factories that make our products were all closed or opening and closing. We weren't able to travel to see anybody. And yet we had a certain amount of demand because people were home baking and, you know, looking after their homes and organizing their homes and all the rest of it. We had that for 18 months and then everyone stopped baking and sort of went on holiday again. And so in our world, it's sort of the market changed very rapidly. Retail stores started to open again and we had the shift from online back into retail. And then since then, we've had obviously the war in Ukraine, which sent energy prices through the roof. We had cost of living crisis, which impacted consumer demand, et cetera, et cetera. So we've been on a roller coaster over the last 4 years. And I think what's been really fascinating, particularly from a, you know, when you're running a business is staying flexible, adaptable, trying to deal with these issues that you're dealing with, some of them for the first time, and having senior leadership team that are flexible, can adapt quick, and at the same time, look for opportunities because there are opportunities. So we've been very focused on, look, yeah, we've got this set of circumstances we have to deal with, but let's go out and try and find the opportunities where we can drive the business forward. We need to adapt where the market's adapting or our consumers are changing the way that they shop. We need to adapt. So it's been a very hectic, roller coaster of 4 years, but we've ended up with quite a different business at the other side. The product has stayed, you know, and our approach to product has stayed core and very much the same, but where our consumers shop, how they shop, where our team work and how they work, has all changed out of all recognition. So it's been fascinating.
So be more specific about that. So how has it fundamentally changed? So life pre-COVID and then everything that's happened since, and not just COVID, like you say, the cost of living crisis, the Ukrainian war, all of those different aspects of modern life that sort of have permeated everyone's lives. How has that fundamentally changed all those things you've just mentioned?
Well, I mean, you know, if we just take sort of work from home, let's say, and where our teams work, and not only our teams, but let's say our, you know, we supply, part of our business supplies retailers. So, big retailers in the UK and overseas as well, they're experiencing the same thing. So they have the same work-life patterns that we have adopted in our business. And getting that to mesh together where you can get FaceTime. I mean, we're a product-based business, so it's very difficult over teams to be explaining new products, you know, and selling those new ideas, etc. So being a product-based business, being face-to-face really helps us. But we've had to adapt to this new world that we're in and everyone is in. So, you know, that alone has been quite a seismic shift. We'd never have thought we would have been able to make it a success before COVID. But here we are 4 years later, and it's ingrained in our business and now the way we work, and we will never go back. It is now, you know, the way of the world going forward. It's just we've been able to adapt.
So do you advocate working from home? Are you a supporter of working from home? Because a lot of people feel that the productivity gets shot to pieces in companies because of this working from home piece. But where do you sit on that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think as a CEO, I would be, it's really interesting. I think if I think about, as it personally, I love face-to-face, and because we're a product-based business, I love that interaction because I love the product debate when we're sitting together as a collective group in a room, debating new ideas or listening to people coming with ideas, et cetera. That is the only way you can really do it successfully. But we also understand that the world has changed and our team's attitude to 5 days in the office has changed. So I think we accept the world we're in and we have to make that work. And ultimately, I think, you know, a great team operates wherever it is, and great people operate wherever they are, et cetera, et cetera. So we concentrate on, making, as we did before, I guess, setting clear objectives, clear vision, clear purpose. Let's all work towards that goal. We do want to develop a, you know, high performance culture. We're ambitious. We want to grow. But we believe that we can do that in the framework of, working from home, working from the office, et cetera. So we're making it work.
Certainly one of the things that I know Ben is always trying to make find a solution for is with designers and engineers and the way in which they think and the way in which they operate is the collaboration piece, just making sure that everyone's on the same path. And there's always, I suspect, this thing with designers where they want to come up with that breakthrough idea. They want to have that light bulb moment, which everyone's like, oh my God, this is amazing. How did this happen? How do you make sure that people, especially when if they're working from home, that they collaborate, that it's a pool of resource as opposed to anyone gunning for just, you know, individual glory, if you like?
Those light bulb moments, particularly in design, are very, very rare and far between. So actually, it all comes through collaboration and working together. We're never searching for that light bulb moment because we just think it's a torturous journey to go on. Whereas when you collaborate, it happens. And I think what we do is we say, okay, look, when we're in the office, and we the way we work is on a rota, so we fix the days when we're in, and that's designed to encourage collaboration because you know when certain people are in and you can have team meetings, etc. And that works well for us. And then the time at home, of course, Teams is available and Zoom, etc., but they're doing a lot more of the sort of maybe the admin work at home and doing more of the face-to-face collaboration stuff when we're in. We've got into a rhythm. We've been doing it for a long time now. We actually have been doing it for well over 2 years, and it sort of it now works well. It works well for us, but it's a new challenge.
And one of the things you mentioned was obviously you've had to navigate this cost of living crisis. How's that affected also your positioning or your price points, your customer, your target market, the people that you thought were your customers? Are they still your customers, or has that shifted? Has that changed? And how have you had to adapt to that? I think one of the things certainly I feel from starting a startup is that I'm very much the customer. I'm very much the person that's going to be the consumer. That's sort of where this nugget of an idea came from when we started developing our powder supplements, that I was that customer. So as you go on that journey and life changes and you get older, how do you stay in touch? How do you keep staying in touch with your customer and what they want to spend on stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot easier to be connected to your customer now today than it was 20 years ago, because obviously we've now got social media, you know, you've got followings and loyalty like you've never had it before. You can understand trends. You know, you can read reviews. I mean, we get product reviews are instant. As soon as we launch a product, we can start seeing what consumers think, what they like and they don't like immediately, and start to react to it. So I think we're more connected now than we've ever been with consumers. I don't think the consumers changed a huge amount, or at least our consumers changed a huge amount. We definitely, of course, are trying to appeal to as wide a group of consumers as we can, where it's relevant. But I mean, I think one of the things we need to do as a business going forward is really sort of get closer to understand, because you can, by learning what's resonating, what's not, what's working, what's not, whether we really have delivered something that's useful, that people want to use and are excited about, means that we can run faster. We can develop, we can move faster. And that's super exciting. I think it's, we definitely prefer the world we're in today than we did probably pre-COVID and even 10 years ago.
How many of those 300 chopping boards are currently propping up the kitchen work surfaces in your home? I imagine everything ends up back at home, does it? Are your house full of stuff, full of prototypes?
It's full of prototypes, none of which look that nice because they're all sort of like, they were all in the development process. So, you know, they're all tucked away in drawers and cupboards and, you know, they don't come out when we have people around, we've got plenty. I mean, loads. And it's everything. I mean, I've got prototypes of everything at home, as you can imagine. And then, you know, you're trying to break stuff. I mean, like, you know, the prototypes we have is like, take it home, use it for 6 months and try and break it. Because ultimately, if we can break it, we can then work out how do we make it better, you know? So
just give it to the kids. Just give it to the kids. They'll solve that.
Yeah, well, exactly that. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I love the fact that you're handing stuff to the children and saying, try and break it. That's not a good life lesson. That's not helpful. What about the emotional connection between a product? Because I imagine this is a little bit like for a product designer, an author writing a book and having a character that they're wedded to in the book and telling the story of that character from beginning, middle, and end. I mean, is that a little bit like how you feel about some of your products or any of them? Have you been on that sort of like emotionally quite connected journey with these products?
I mean, definitely. I mean, so I'd say very, very few, but there are a couple where I have a strong emotional connection. I mean, as sad as it sounds, and one of them is a chopping board. But there were two sort of, for us, in the early days, there were two sort of breakthrough moments for us. One was when we were very, very, when we were probably less than 2 years old and we were struggling to make the business a success and we were running out of money. And we had these four products, of which one was a glass chopping board. And there was a buyer at a department store in the UK that had the belief in us, and she shouldn't really have. And she backed us just on our chopping boards. And that saved our bacon and meant the business survived. That was one. And she also said to us, look, I love what you do with the chopping boards. Do more, because I'm the kitchen buyer of this department store and I'll buy more from you. I'm not the clock buyer. You need to go and see the clock buyer. The clock buyer wasn't interested at all, but the kitchen. So she definitely was, there was that moment where it really saved the business. And, you know, then we then sort of went from there and went forward sort of with strength. And the second one was sort of finding this very old design for a folding chopping board in a museum in America, New York. And me contacting I found it in this permanent exhibition. I contacted the designer who lived in Windsor in the UK. And I said, look, we'd love to redesign this with you. And this was this folding chopping board called Chopped Apart. And it's still in the range today. So it's been out for probably 16 years. We've been selling it for 16 years. It still sells really well today. It's brilliantly simple, fantastically functional, solves a really clear problem because it just, chopping board folds into a chute. So you pour the contents into a pot as opposed to scraping them on, you know, missing the pot and all over the countertop, et cetera. And that was all about, you know, brilliantly useful design and brilliantly functional design. And it also was that moment where we're like, this is what we're going to do. It is all about functional design. And so those two moments. So from a product point of view, the one that I closest to is this folding chopping board called Chop to Pot.
But there's something rather lovely about that, isn't there? Because actually it was functional and brilliant then, and it's still functional and brilliant now. And that is a classic yep. example of a classic piece of engineering, and it survives the test of time.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's why we focus on functionality, because it's very much like, it's not like, does it look nice? Well, I think it looks nice. I don't think it looks nice. You know, but it's very much like, does it do the job? Yes, it does. You know, and then it's sort of, for us, it's all about trying to solve the problem. Like I say, if you hear someone say, why hasn't someone thought of it before? You know, you've got it right. So we're on that hunt constantly.
So it feels to me like there is this woman working in the kitchenware department of this big department store that is no longer a department store, that is no longer there, that actually was pivotal in the direction in which you flowed your business. Because had it not been for her being the kitchen buyer and saying, that's what I do and I'll back you, would you have gone into kitchenware?
I mean, I think it was at a point in time where we were developing in the early stages our direction and what we were looking for and the direction we were going to go in. And it came at a great time. So it was sort of, the timing was perfect because she really helped us probably on that journey. And we were also thinking, we want to survive. We want to make a little bit of money to get the next product out, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll just do what she's saying. You know, it was just sort of like that. We'll go with her. We really like her. She seems to, you know, she's going to back us, you know, let's do it. And so we were lucky with the timing. We were lucky that she got behind us. And the next stage in the development worked.
That's like a perfect example of when luck and opportunity meet each other and you're able to do something about it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think I always reference that as an important moment in our journey because she didn't have to back us. You know, we were a tiny little company, but she sort of saw something in us and took a risk. So, you know, which is great for us.
Yeah, for sure. My God, amazing. One thing I wanted to ask you about the product that got away. We talked earlier about this emotional connection with various products. Yeah. Has there been a product that you've been madly, keenly passionate about bringing to market that for whatever reason, whether it's the economics of it or the timing or whatever that might be, it just didn't happen? Is there something that you're, and it still sort of sits there in a locker somewhere ready for another day at some point when it might be right?
I mean, yeah, so there's been, you know, lots of sort of mad, probably what would be considered mad ideas or disruptive ideas that never saw the light of day. We were developing, we launched a compaction bin. So we were very much about like, you know, we all live in small spaces and waste is a problem. Particularly if you live in apartments, et cetera, waste is a problem. So we wanted to do a bin, a trash can for the kitchen that compacts the waste. We have launched one, which is a mechanical compactor. It holds three times as much waste. It's really a really great product. But on the development journey, we went through powered. We looked at powering a compactor and we created a mangle that basically you could put pretty much anything through and it would crush it. But this thing was never going to make it commercially because it was sort of, you know, it required some serious engineering. It weighed half a ton, but boy, did it do a brilliant job at compacting waste. But I think what in our minds we felt, if we could develop the technology, we could then maybe transfer it into a consumer product. So we came up with the technology. It worked brilliantly, and we had a lot of fun putting loads of stuff through it, which we shouldn't be putting through it, and it compacted it. But we could never make it a commercial success because it was too over the top.
And will you ever find a home for it in a reduced version at some point?
I don't think we'll ever make it in that in its current guise. I mean, I think the mechanical version that we created came off the back of it. We still have it in the archive. You know, we've got a wonderful archive of product because there will be at some point we go back into the archive and look at stuff we did. You know, where maybe the market has moved on, or maybe technology has moved on, or power. You know, battery powers have moved on, et cetera, where we can bring something back. And, you know, I'd love to do something with the Science Museum on our archive, because I think there's some sort of crazy, wacky ideas in there that, you know, and will may never see the light of day, but are just interesting from a design development point of view, you know, to see sort of the path we took. So hold out hope, but we'll see.
Maybe yeah, but you know, from those crazy moments comes that, you know, the gem of something that can be fundamentally game changing. And we talk about disrupting and being a disruptor. Why is it so important for you in your world to be disruptors?
So that is a really great question. It's something we talk to the team about. I think this is really important. And this is just, I think, important for any business, is that, you know, it's a competitive world out there. Generally, there's oversupply. There's more companies producing stuff than we need and want to consume. A lot of people are trying to be better. Everyone's trying to be better than each other to some degree. And so therefore, if I'm a consumer looking at the world, I get bombarded by lots of different options. And if you can try to be different and disruptive and really go beyond where a lot of other competitors go, and really push those boundaries to offer something really unique and different that is useful and purposeful, solves a problem, you have a higher chance of success, I think. And so we think. So that for us is the journey we've gone. It's also super exciting. You're breaking new ground or trying to break new ground. You know, that we're on a journey. We're on a journey with our business to try and continue to build it in the future, but, you know, and develop really great new innovative products. So that's the bit we love. So the disruptive journey is exciting. I think if it's just about trying to be better than the next guy, it's not that exciting. You know, you want to break new ground. So that's very much our mantra and strategy, you know, for the future.
It sounds like a good one, a solid one. And what about in terms of you and in terms of the people that you work with? I mean, you're asking them to perform on a daily basis. You're asking them to be disruptors, to come up with different ideas, and then to make those ideas, you know, from concept to reality. What do you think is a good piece of advice, a tip for people in everyday life for performance? Like, what do you do every day that you think helps you every day to perform better?
So I think one of the things, if focus is very important. Try and do what you do, be the best at what you do. And like, okay, so if it's in our world, you know, do one thing really, really well and just be brilliant at it and be better than everybody else. So focus, and it's, you know, as success comes, I guess, you get loads of opportunities that come and it can then become quite distracting. But actually, if you go back to your core principles that were what got me to where we are today, and try and, you know, focus on that and be better at it. Because if it got you to where you were today and you're successful, it will continue to deliver as you develop it. So I think focus is really important for us anyway. From my perspective, I mean, it requires a huge amount of, you know, it's hard work, it requires persistence, etc. I'm an early riser. I love getting up early in the morning. You know, I'm you know, getting to the office very early, usually probably the first one in. And I like to get all the difficult tasks done and completed by at least 11 a.m. You know, the really challenging stuff, I get it done first thing in the morning, because it's when I've got the clearest head. I probably have slept on it overnight and I've got clarity of what needs to happen. So I get on my to-do list, I put all the difficult stuff at the top and try and get it done first thing in the morning. And then maybe leave the more creative stuff to later in the day. So that would be my sort of, I guess, two tips.
No, that makes perfect sense, especially if you're sort of an early morning person as opposed to a night owl. I found a new thing for you to be able to do with your chopping board, by the way. The other day I discovered that what you could also use it for is if you're cutting hair of a child, as I was with foxes the other day, it catches the hair in it.
Oh,
because
amazing.
The sides fold up to the side and you've got, you know, effectively a funnel for the hair, for a place to go. So there you go, you've got a multitasking chopping board.
I know. When we come out with our hair care line, you'll be getting commission.
I better be at this rate.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Rich, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Lovely to chat to you. Thanks, Georgie.